The topic this evening is important because sometimes we want to know what is running our life and actually how we can improve our life and our situation. Is it being controlled by some forces beyond us, or are we in control? What is the place of a God, a divinity, or gods, or devas, as they say in Buddhism, or spirits, or even monks? Have we got power to help you, or can you only help yourself? And this is an important subject because many people in this world believe the power lies outside of you in some divinity or in some God. And because of that, as I will say later on in this talk, it's not a harmless superstition, but it is actually a harmful superstition. And I will mention this in the talk as we go on. But first of all, that human beings throughout our history have always posited the existence of some god or powerful figure outside of themselves. And because of that, they have done many ceremonies to pray, to beseech, to ask for favors. And sometimes even you may be a Buddhist and still do such things, to go to the temple and pray for good luck, so that that nice-looking girl you like will fall in love with you, or that the job you are after will come your way, or that your examinations will go better for you. And sometimes, even as Buddhists, we do this. Should we really do this or not? Now, first of all, we have different hierarchies which we think exist in this world. And people have often posited the ultimate hierarchy of a god. And I was actually just reading, it was quite independent of this talk this evening, because I was going to Sri Lanka tomorrow, and a professor at the University of WA just handed me some papers. And there was a beautiful quote there from the Christian leader, one of the earliest Christians, St. Augustine, who put the problem in a very succinct way when he said that either God can't stop evil or won't stop evil. If he can't, it means he's not omnipotent. If he won't, it means he's not benevolent. But what it meant was, now, there are problems and difficulties which we face in this world, such as tsunamis, such as cancers, such as accidents happening to young children, such as hurricanes. The list of human disasters keeps going on through every year. And sometimes we think, well, if there is some supreme power, surely they should intervene and stop, because very often there seems to be no reason or just cause why, say, children should suffer, or people who live good lives get swept away in some tsunami, or something terrible happens to people who don't seem to deserve the cancer or the other misfortunes which happen. And that has caused many people to question if there is some divine, powerful person above us. Why don't they intervene? And this is in the 3rd or 4th century. I forget when St. Augustine lived, but he was one of the very influential early theologians of the Christian church, who said, well, if there is a God, what is he doing? Why doesn't they intervene? And if it's not just a god, sometimes as Buddhists we believe in devas or goddess of mercies or whatever else we believe in. Why don't they intervene more often to solve the problems and difficulties of life? And it's a question which deserves an answer. Certainly, that after things like the tsunami, I was called by the press immediately after the tsunami, because many people were asking those questions of all the major religions. And the newspaper wanted to ask, what does a Buddhist think about the tsunami? What caused it? Is it some reason that human beings have been misbehaving and this is some punishment from some higher authority? Why did this happen? And of course, the Buddhist answer was that, let's put aside why it has happened. The most important thing to do is actually to work hard to solve the problems of people without homes, people with injuries, people without food. And I said, let's put aside the cause for the time being, because that's wasting the time when we could be helping and serving people. Later on, we can start talking about causes. And it's similar to the floods which are in the southern part of Malaysia, just over the causeway in Johor. When I was in Malaysia a couple of weeks ago, people were saying the first people actually were helping were from the Buddhist temples in the south. And apparently the first people who were in Aceh were the Suu Kyi Foundation. And many people, instead of hammering and say, why did this happen to me? In other words, looking for some divine cause or explanation why these things happen. As a rational person, as a Buddhist person, we should think, what are we doing about this? And this is exactly what the Buddha said when he gave the very famous simile of the person shot by an arrow. Instead of wondering who shot the arrow, whether it was a girl or a boy, whether it was old or young, what race, what caste, what gender they were, you don't really think about who shot the arrow if you're shot with an arrow. You want to get the arrow out first of all. And the most important thing here is that we are active in solving the problems before we start to think who caused them. However, because in the end people start to think, why did these things happen? We should investigate clearly and rationally. And for most of the things which happen, both good and bad in this world, there is a logical cause, a reasonable cause. And you know the reason why there was a tsunami? Was because we live on an earth which is molten, which with a very thin crust on the outside, which is always moving. The shift of the tectonic plates. It's nature that this happens. It's not some bad luck. It's just the fact of nature that when you live this life, such things will happen. And to illustrate this story from, or this point, from a story from my youth as a monk in northeast Thailand, with a very wise teacher called Ajahn Chah. Once there was a man who came to see him who had been drafted into the Thai army and had been shot, and not critically wounded, but severely wounded and disabled. And so he came to see my teacher wanting some sort of blessing because he thought he had bad luck. It was bad luck. Why did this happen to me? I was shot. And Ajahn Chah looked at him and said, what do you mean, bad luck? You're a soldier. That's what happens when you become a soldier. You shoot bullets at other people. You should expect other people to shoot bullets at you. And some soldiers are going to get hit with those bullets. And that happened to be you. You should have read the contract when you joined up. In the same way, anyone who is going to be suffering from a cancer or from a tsunami or a hurricane or any other what we so-called misfortune, it's actually part of the contract of being born as a human being. Didn't you read the agreement before you got born? It's part of being a human being. If you read the small print, it says you can die at any time of any cause. And usually it's sometimes the most unfortunate time. But some of us will. That is the reason. Now, the point is that when we understand that there are natural reasons for this, and it's not some intelligent design. I was reading earlier also that the idea of intelligent design was being debunked maybe even 100 years ago, when the French philosopher and playwright Voltaire said, well, if it's intelligent design, that makes a lot of sense to him, he said, because that's why we have a nose. It's been designed to hold on our glasses. Or the reason he said that rabbits, this was the philosopher Bertrand Russell, Obviously, rabbits have been intelligently designed to have a white tail on their backside to make them easier to shoot. They were making fun of the idea of an intelligent design to say that there is a much more obvious reason why people are like we are now. And that reason is, you know, it is the evolutionary impulse, and it is caused, and much of the driving force behind evolution is our craving, is our desire. This is actually what motivates the changes which we have. Even that any neurologist will tell you now that your brain is plastic. In other words, you can change your neural connections just because of what you want to be. Sometimes people don't realize the power of your own craving and how we can change things. But this goes to karma, and I'll bring that up again later. But first of all, I wanted to stick with the dangers of believing that these things are caused by something outside of yourself, by a God or a divine being. Because what that means, instead of having early warning systems for the next tsunami, instead of having preventative measures such as building our houses away from the shoreline, instead of making other precautions, too often if we think that it's a divine intervention is all that's necessary, we'll end up praying to some sort of God or to a Buddha or a Bodhisattva or whatever, instead of doing what we should really be doing. And sometimes that the prayer, the beseeching of a divine being, is at the expense of other actions, which we should really be doing. A story behind this, which happened in my monastery some years ago, Angie already introduced the fact that when I went to Australia, first of all, I was just number two monk, and there was an abbot in front of me. And when he disrobed, it was, I was literally left holding the baby. I never wanted to be abbot, but these things just happen to you. So when I became an abbot, I decided, well, I'll see what happens. If I am a good teacher, that'll be wonderful, because many people will come and listen, I can serve Buddhism. If I'm a terrible teacher and no one comes, that's even better, because then they would leave me alone, I can become a hermit. Which is what I always wanted to do. But still people keep coming. Actually, these days I say it must be because I'm a terrible teacher, that so many people keep coming back again and again and again. Because a good teacher, I would have enlightened you already the last time I came here, so you never needed to come again. So a good teacher always gets rid of their disciples, like in school. Imagine that you went to school and you had to keep coming back again year after year after year after year, they'd sack that teacher. So I must be a terrible teacher, you keep coming back again. But no, that when I was the second monk there, one day I think she was a Singaporean girl. She was studying at the university in Perth. It was time for her examinations, and so she came to get some special prayers so that she would pass her exams. And you know what happened? She failed. But when she failed, she didn't blame herself. She blamed us. She said, these monks, these Ang Mo monks, they can't chant. They don't know what they're doing. Now, of course, she was trying to depend upon some divine intervention, thinking that she could pass her exams if she prayed to God, if she made some chanting, if she gave donations, if she gave something. That's not how you pass examinations. You all know how you pass examinations. You've got to study, you've got to work, you've got to go to all the lectures. Now, because she thought divine intervention or monkish intervention would work, that's why she didn't work hard enough. That's why she failed. sometimes if you think that some monk can pray his way through your problems, you're asking for trouble. If you think that just supplicating some higher authority is much better than you acting properly, again, you're asking for problems. Even if there is some divine authority, imagine what would it be like at his switchboard. It would be like ringing up and hearing the message, "Your prayer is important to us, but all our operators are busy right now. Can you please hold on? There's too many people." And I don't think even God can outsource to Bangalore. So, it's a bit impossible. And anyway, as I was saying, sometimes, as St. Augustine said, that if God can, why doesn't he? If he doesn't, it may not be good. They may not be omnipotent. Even supreme beings or heavenly beings can make mistakes sometimes. As in the following story, which I promised I would tell. Some years ago, I don't know if you heard this in the newspapers, but the Pope and the Archbishop of Canterbury were trying actually to get some accommodation. They were both Christians together. Why can't we work together? And after some discussion, they thought, let's let God decide which one of us has got the right form of Christianity. So they decided to settle the matter with a game of golf. And the agreement was, if the Archbishop of Canterbury won, then the Pope would become an Anglican. But if the Pope won, the Archbishop would become a Catholic. That'd be fair enough. Let God decide. So it was a very close match. It all, those of you who play golf, it all came down to the last hole. And at the last hole, after driving down the fairway and hitting the green, the Pope was two shots in front. He only needed just to hold his putt and he would win by two shots. So he asked his caddy, who happened to be a nun, for the putter. And he lined up, it wasn't a hard putt, he lined up the putter, he looked at the green to see which way it would go round. And he did a little prayer, and he hit the ball. For those of you who play golf, you know that sometimes the ball goes straight for the hole and just catches the rim and goes past it. He missed. And because of his excitement, he said, "Damn it, missed." He swore. And the nun, his caddy, crossed herself and said, "Your Holiness, you shouldn't swear like that," looking up in the sky. And of course, the Pope said, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry. Just, it's too exciting. I'm very sorry. I won't do it again." And so he had another putt. And if he got this one in, again, he's win by one stroke. And he lined it up. He hit the ball. But again, because of his nervousness, this was a very important putt. It went way past the hole. And so a second time he said, "Damn it, missed." And the nun crossed herself, looked up in the sky and said, "You shouldn't tempt the heavens. Don't say that again." And he said, "I'm terribly sorry. It's just the excitement. It's an important match." And he had one more shot. And if he got this in, he would even the score. It would be a draw. But if he missed, he'd be in big trouble. So he lined it up. And this time, he hit the ball straight towards the hole. But it stopped a millimeter before. And the third time, he said, "Damn it, missed." And this time, before the nun had a chance to cross herself, there was a big thunderbolt from up in the sky. And this lightning, this bolt of lightning, came straight down and hit the nun. And killed her. And this great voice came out of the sky. "Damn it, missed." Now I got that joke from a Christian. Because even sometimes supreme beings miss the target too. The point is that we cannot rely on divine intervention. We can't rely on it. Sometimes there is some intervention. I know cases of this. But it is extremely rare that we have any divine intervention. One case which I will mention is this. There was one of the close supporters of my monastery. It was a Thai girl. She had promised to bring the meal to my monastery one day. But because of the demands of her business, it was a big order which she had to fulfill. So she worked all night packing the goods ready for dispatch in the early morning. So she hadn't slept all night. And she really should have just phoned me up and said, look, I'm sorry I can't go that day. But she decided, no, she'd made a promise. She quickly cooked some food, put it in the back of her car, and started the 1 hour drive from Perth to my monastery. She hadn't slept all night. So on the way, on the highway, she fell asleep at the wheel. Now many people die that way. You should really rest before you go on journeys in a vehicle. Maybe not just killing yourself, but killing other people as well. And she told me she survived the journey because this is what happened. She'd fallen asleep. She was in the car by herself. And she felt somebody slap her on the cheek hard. Hard enough to wake her up. When she opened her eyes, her vehicle had drifted into the right-hand lane and there was a big truck coming straight in her direction. She just had time to swerve back into the left-hand side of the road. It was only a two-lane highway with no median strip in between. She just had time to swerve into the correct lane and save her life. It was a one-hour journey. She fell asleep a second time, and this time she was drifting off the edge of the road on the left into the hard shoulder and into the fences and the fields outside the road. Again, something slapped her hard to wake her up. And it happened a third time, she said. Again, drifted onto the opposite side of the road with another car coming in her direction. She said those three slaps saved her life, allowing her to get to my monastery in one piece. When she told me that story, I said, that will only happen if you're coming to a monastery. If you fell asleep going to the casino, no one would wake you up. There is divine intervention, but only when you're doing good things. So be careful there. You cannot rely on heavenly beings who are very high-minded. That's the only reason why they can be in such positions of power. They're high-minded beings, and they won't help you if you're doing lowly things. They only help people who have high aspirations. But be careful there, because the best thing for that woman would not to rely on divine intervention. She was very fortunate there. The best thing for her would have been to take a rest and not do something so dangerous. And it's important that we rely on our own abilities rather than divine intervention, because that makes life very dangerous. One of the examples which really concerned me when I was a young man, I was actually the first time I went on a pilgrimage to India. The Buddhist Fellowship organizes many pilgrimages. The first time I went on a pilgrimage was in 1973, because I was already a Buddhist and I decided to go overland to India to try and see some of the holy sites. But when I arrived in India, I had bad diarrhea. So I thought I'd go up to Kashmir to recuperate the long overland journey from London before visiting the holy sites. So I got on a bus to go into the Kashmir Valley in 1973. In those days, the road from Jammu into Kashmir was going over the mountains. It was a single track road. It was a gravel road, unsealed, and the mountains were so steep that if you looked through the right-hand window of the vehicle, you could see this almost vertical cliff going up. If you looked on the left-hand window of the bus, you saw a vertical cliff going down. There was no railings, and it looked very dangerous. And every so often, you'd look down and you'd see a bus, just like the one we were traveling in, a complete wreck. Many buses had fallen over the side. And the bus driver was going so fast that myself and two other Americans who were also on that bus, we got so scared, we decided to try and ask the driver to slow down. If there was a boulder, a rock fall, we would not have time to stop. If there was another vehicle coming in the opposite direction, it would be a head-on collision. There was no way round. It was a single-track road. It was dangerous, legitimately so. So we asked the driver, "Can you please slow down?" And the driver said, "Don't need to worry. If it's God's will we go over, it's God's will." That never actually satisfied us at all. I said, "I'm a Buddhist." And I thought about that afterwards. Because the person believed they were being divinely protected, it meant they were being heedless driving that vehicle. And they could have killed themselves. And it's because that many other drivers had believed they were being protected. That was the reason why so many buses had gone over. Can you see the danger here? When you believe in somebody protecting you, that the prayers or the amulets or whatever else people believe in for divine protection, it means we are not really working to protect ourselves or protect society. We're just giving the problem to someone else who cannot really help. So it's important that we take responsibility, which is what the law of karma means. What the Buddha taught, what the Buddha found out, was that you each have to take responsibility for your happiness, for your health, for your longevity. It's up to you to work hard for this. And if you don't work hard and you give the job to somebody else, if you think, "Oh, all I need to do is to ask Ajahn Brahm to help with my business. All you need to do is to make some offering to a temple. All you need to do is to do some prayers to some powerful beings." You think that's all that's necessary to make your business work? You are really asking for trouble. You have to take responsibility. Now, I'm going to read out now a paper, or some paragraphs from a paper, which was a very interesting piece of research. Quite unexpected. This was from the Journal of Religion and Society, 2005. Because I was a scientist before, and I've mentioned in this building before that there's two types of spirituality to be found in our world. First of all, there's those who bend the facts to fit their faith, and those who bend the faith to fit their facts. And we always have to bend faith to fit the facts of life. And much of the facts of life actually come from science, come from research. And this is a fascinating piece of research which was done recently from the Journal of Religion and Society by a researcher called Gregory Paul, who wanted to test out whether the belief in a supreme or a higher being actually makes for a more ethical society. This is his results. He compared data from 18 developed democracies. And he discovered that in general, higher rates of belief in and worship of a creator correlate with higher rates of homicide, juvenile and early adult mortality, sexually transmitted disease infection rates, teen pregnancy and abortion. Whereas none of the strongly secularized pro-evolution democracies is experiencing high levels of measurable dysfunction. Within the United States, the strongly theistic anti-evolution South and Midwest have markedly worse homicide, mortality, sexually transmitted disease, youth pregnancy, marital and related problems than in the northeast of the U.S., where secularization and acceptance of evolution approach European norms. Three sets of findings stand out: the association between such religion, especially absolute belief, and juvenile mortality, venereal diseases, and adolescent abortion. Mr. Gregory Paul's graphs show far higher rates of death among the under fives in Portugal, the US, and Ireland, and put the US, the most religious country in his service, in a league of its own for gonorrhea and syphilis. Strangest of all, for those who believe that such societies are pro-life, is the finding that increasing adolescent abortion rates show positive correlation with increasing belief and worship of a creator. What this research was actually showing, that when we believe in a supreme being or a creator and we give responsibility for those, we don't take adequate precautions. In other words, that young people who believe that God will sort it out, or Jesus will sort it out, or Kuan Yin will sort it out, or someone else will sort it out, don't take precautions in their sexual conduct. They don't use condoms. They think that it does not matter, I can pray my way out of the problem. We're not really taking responsibility. The point of this, and it's the most important point, is for the well-being of society, for the well-being of Singapore, for the well-being of the world. We cannot just abrogate our responsibility and think that we can pray or beseech some being. That usually, only when we take personal responsibility for our health and well-being, we take personal responsibility for the health, well-being, and prosperity of our communities. Only when we realize this law of karma, which is responsibility, which we take for ourselves, is most important. Only then will we have health and progress and well-being. And that's what the research was showing. In what you call secular societies, there people take responsibility. We take responsibility for our health. We take responsibility for our prosperity. We take responsibility for our sexuality. This is what we mean by the law of karma. As the Buddha said, each one of us is responsible for our karma. We are heirs of our karma, born of our karma. We inherit our karma. So this is why that when people ask me, they have a problem. We say, well, what are you doing about this? Stop praying. Stop beseeching. And the job, the role of monks, the role of teachers is to help people. One of the other problems is, it's an authority problem, a responsibility problem. Because when we have like higher authorities, sometimes it's like having a mother or father. Sometimes when you're a little child, you think mummy or daddy will be able to sort it out. I remember when I was a young monk in Thailand, when I was responsible for helping with the visas of the monks in Ajahn Chah's monasteries. That was a job which I took on. And I remember visiting the American embassy in Bangkok and seeing big posters there which said, it does not matter how rich your daddy is, he will not be able to get you out of prison or out of the death sentence if you are bringing in drugs. It was a warning to the young men and women, especially from the United States, who brought or took drugs in the country of Thailand who thought that, no, my daddy is rich, he can get me out of the situation if I get caught. The embassy was warning, doesn't matter how powerful or rich your daddy is, he cannot get you out of the problem. The law of that country is the law of that country. You'll be prosecuted, maybe even get the death sentence. And it's the same, doesn't matter how big your daddy is up in heaven. He cannot get you out of the problem of responsibility for your karma. Otherwise, it doesn't feel just to me. Justice, the inherent justice, should be that we're each responsible. That people should get good grades at university, not because they know a good monk who can chant for them, but because they work hard, they deserve their good grades. That people should be rewarded for their effort in their business. That if they work hard and they're innovative, then yes, they will do well. They deserve their wealth. They should be rewarded for their social skills. So if they are kind and caring, this, they will get a nice partner and be happy together. That justice demands, my idea of justice demands fairness. Not just because that you know someone up in heaven who can fix things for you. That doesn't seem right to me. That's why when I first heard about the law of karma, it made so much sense to me. It was like justice. That people get what they deserve. And that doesn't mean just the negative. It means the happiness. For those of you who have a happy relationship, have a good job, have good health, who are reasonably in good shape, congratulations, well done, you deserve that. And many of you are in good shape. Now, I come from Australia and come over here. You're so lucky you get so much rain here. So sometimes you might have complained, oh, it's raining this evening, and I got wet coming from the MRT or coming from the bus, coming into the temple. You are so lucky for the rain. Sometimes we think, oh, we have to work so hard in Singapore. You're so lucky you have a job to do. You might think, oh, it's, you know, so difficult or whatever else it is. Please understand that, you know, Singapore, if you go to many other places in the world, is a beautiful, wonderful country. And I say that as an outsider, even though some people in Perth spend more time in Singapore than back home. But nevertheless, you deserve your happiness and your well-being and your safety. It's a hard work which you've done. So what the law of karma means is that you should rejoice in your happiness, in your health, in your well-being. And if there is a problem in your life, any difficulties, things which have gone wrong, find out why and fix it up. We learn from it. So what the law of karma means is we take responsibility and we learn from life. So when things go wrong, we don't think this is God's punishment. What we think is, what did I do? Can I do it better next time? We learn from our mistakes. We don't just learn from our mistakes. Karma means not just the negative. It's not just bad karma, it's good karma as well. If you're having a good time, if your business is prosperous, why? We learn from our successes as well. And of those two, in the law of karma, you learn much more from your successes than you learn from your mistakes. Which means, if you're having a wonderful time in your marriage, or if you have many happy days in your marriage, why? Find out what works in your relationship with your partner. Find out what makes her happy, what makes him happy. Learn from that and repeat that. Which is what I mean learning from the results of good karma. You can make the marriage work. Or, if your business is going well, you know what business is like. Sometimes it goes well, sometimes it doesn't go well. When it's going well, why? You've done some good karma there. You've had some good innovation there. Learn from it. That's how I build my success. I don't worry about the times when I've made mistakes. I learn from my successes. What worked? And that's what I repeat. So in your worldly life, in your job, if you get a promotion, why did you get that promotion? Learn from it. And you'll find that learning from your successes is really understanding the law of karma and being a responsible person who becomes a prosperous and happy person. What the Buddha was saying is that the responsibility lies with you, not with some supreme being, not with some other leader, but with you. Too often, the religions have become authoritarian. By authoritarian, is saying that I can make you happy or I can make you miserable. And sometimes we're afraid of such power invested in other beings. But what Buddhism says is that all we can do is to lead you, is to give you advice. Buddhas only show the way, which is empowering everybody to be independent, to be wise, to take responsibility for their career, for their education, for their health, and for their emotional life. And that research was actually showing that people who take that personal responsibility are actually much more effective. They do reach much better goals. Happier, more prosperous, with less social problems in their communities. People who take that personal responsibility, they have less abortions, less homicides, less crime, less divorces. Everything seems to go better when you work at it. To me, it's obvious, however, that still in today's world, we spend too much time asking and praying for other people to help us instead of doing it ourselves. Even in education, the modern mantra is not actually giving you the information, but teaching you how to think, encouraging you how to learn, empowering you with the ability to find the information for yourself. The time when the teacher is the ultimate authority has long gone. The teacher is there to give you the power. And too often, the older religions are still keeping the power to themselves, saying you have to do this right. You have to perform this ceremony. You have to make this prayer. And if you don't, things are going to go wrong. And the point is that people have tried that and they found it doesn't work. In The Lancet, the journal of the British Medical Association, last year in 2006, they reported the results of the Great Prayer Experiment. I think it was 238 cases of people with cardiac problems in the hospitals, about 6 or 7 hospitals in the United States, were the subjects of research to see if prayer or chanting actually increased or decreased their recovery rates. It was a double-blind experiment by which it meant that people who were doing the chanting and the prayers, and it was not just in Christian temples, it was a Buddhist temple was involved, Jewish church, there was many, many different religions were involved in this experiment. Some were chanting for people who didn't exist. Some had names of people who were in the wards of the cardiac departments of several hospitals. And some people in the list were being chanted on, some weren't. And they did not know who was being chanted for and who wasn't. So they wanted to find out the best possible rational way whether chanting actually works. You know what they found? A very, very clear that it didn't work. That people who were chanted on did not have any significant increase in their recovery rate for those people who didn't receive any chanting. If anything, the people who received chanting actually were worse off. If anything, but statistically sort of small. It was a wonderful experiment to say, does chanting really work or not? Now, this was a case of chanting at a distance. Obviously, if you do some prayer and chanting in front of someone, just the very fact that you're caring for them, the very fact that they may believe in it, that will have an effect. Moreover, there is sometimes when there is a psychic effect as well. And I've seen that happen, but that's very, very rare. And that usually only happens with very, very high-minded, virtuous people, not by people who charge for their chanting. My chanting is priceless. In other words, we never charge for anything. Anything which I do is always for free. You know why I do that? It's because you feed me for free. Every day I get fed by devout Buddhists and non-Buddhists who feed me for nothing at all. They come to my monastery, even here this afternoon. Someone took me for tea and gave me some cheese and chocolate, which in our tradition was allowed in the afternoon. Tomorrow morning they take me to their house and they feed me. And they never give me a bill. All the years I've been coming to Singapore, never once have I got a bill for all the dhanas you've given me. You feed me for free, so I will serve you for free. And it's a wonderful thing to be part of this exchange where you're not involved with money at all. What that means is you have like a higher virtue. And that higher virtue gives you higher power. Remember, the purity of the mind is what gives you power. So you can actually see what a pure mind is. And only people with very, very pure minds, especially trained in meditation, then their chanting can have an effect. It's mind on mind.
Ajahn Brahm, bodhisattvas such as Avalokiteshvara, Maitreya, had taken the vow that they will become enlightened only after all suffering have disappeared. So don't these bodhisattvas or devas help people in trouble?
They can't really help people in trouble, because all we can actually help, just like Buddhas, Buddhas will only show the way. They teach Dharma, they teach truth. Because if I help you, it's like a mother. If you help your child with the homework, then they're not learning how to do the homework themselves. In other words, if you just do the homework for them. How many of you would do that for your child, do the homework for them? That's being an irresponsible parent. As a parent, your job, because you love your child, is to help them learn how to do the homework. And that's what a bodhisattva would do. You help people learn about life, but you don't do the examinations or the homework for them. So a real bodhisattva was sometimes like a real mother. Sometimes you have to let your child get sort of like measles or whatever, because that's the way they will build up their immunity when they grow old. You have to allow them to get a cold. Sometimes you have to allow them to go to school and actually interact with other children, even though there may be some degree of bullying or competition, because they have to learn about life and get strong. So sometimes if we're overprotective, we're not really caring and loving another person with wisdom. So real bodhisattvas, like real mothers, they can care for their children, but they don't just solve every problem for them.
If chanting or prayer at a distance doesn't work, what about transference of merits?
Transference of merits can work if it's a relation of yours, someone you know. And that is, again, a contacting. Again, that chanting can work if it's a relation, someone you're very close to. But it can't work, it usually doesn't work if it's like some other person who's distant from you. The reason why it works with a close relation is there is connection, psychic connections, because you've been together, you've grown up together, you've loved each other. And the story obviously is, and many of you have had these experiences or known about these experiences, when, say, a son of yours is in London, has a car accident, you know it right here in Singapore that something's wrong.
How does that happen? It's happened many, many times. It may have happened to you. How do you know that something's wrong? It's because the two of you are so close together, you've grown up together, that there is a connection there which, like space, does not diminish. They could be in New York, they could be in Chicago. But if something's wrong with them, you know. Now that sort of connection between loved ones is what we exploit for the transference of merits. Maybe your mother has died, or your grandfather. If you've loved them very well, very much, even just thinking about them, you get a connection with them. And it's through that connection that you can transfer merits. But the more distant they are, the harder it is to do.
At the end of chanting, monks use flowers to sprinkle water on us. Uh-huh. What is the significance of this?
Yeah, it sort of cools you off sometimes. But now, Ajahn Chah, you know, this master of mine, he would very, very rarely do that. But one day, this general came to see him, a major general. I remember this was about 25 years ago. And this was a time when Thailand was run by the military. It's obviously run by the military again now, but this is the time when the military were the power. So he usually did not mess around with generals. And this general came to bow to Ajahn Chah, can I have some holy water? Say, I haven't got any, says Ajahn Chah. No, please, I want some holy water. Okay, come here, bow down. And Ajahn Chah spat on the general's head. And I thought, my goodness, Ajahn Chah's gone too far this time. And not only that, he got his hand and rubbed it into his hair. Now that was really pushing your luck. But the general actually loved every minute of it. And the other holy water story I've got is that when I was in when I was a young monk in Thailand, one day every week we would not sleep. We'd meditate all night. So after meditating all night, not having slept for 24, 36 hours, you were very, very tired and sleepy. It was like a strict practice to see how tough you were. And I remember one morning, after meditating all night, sort of going out of the hall to urinate. And it was, you know, in the forest, the jungle. You didn't need to go to the toilet because it was jungle. And it was the early light of morning. So I was tired, I couldn't see very clearly. And I thought I was urinating on a stick. And then it started to wiggle. I was urinating on a snake. And the most sensitive part of my anatomy was only a few inches from its mouth. But, you know what I mean. But that snake never bit me. Even though I peed on a snake, the snake thought it was holy water.
There are not many monks who tell jokes like this.
That's true. It's not a joke, it's a true story.
Okay, there are not many monks who tell stories like this.
Have you ever peed on a snake? You've got to be very, you have to be a holy monk, otherwise the snake will bite you.
A prominent American scientist, Dr. Colin Francis, head of DNA research, claims that God, through intelligent design, created the world through evolution. He was able to do this because he exists outside of nature, time and space. What are your comments?
Okay, if God exists out of nature, time and space, if he's outside, he has to remain outside. In other words, if they're really outside of time and space, they've got no meaning to us because we live in time and space. Either you're outside this hall or you're inside. Either you're outside of life or you're inside of life. So if you look about that rationally, that doesn't hold water. That's untenable. Even if they have like what they call in modern philosophy the God of the gaps. In other words, the one who pushed the button to start the whole process of the evolution of this universe from theoretical physics. Remember, I was a physicist before I became a monk.
The whole evolution of the stars and solar systems and planets is very easy to understand. The Big Bang, you've all heard of the Big Bang, but it's actually what started the Big Bang. The first fraction of a second is, again, we don't know what started it. So people can say, oh, that must have been God. That's why they call it the God of the gaps. But if it started it, can it intervene? It can only intervene if it's inside time and space, not if it's outside. So it can't be outside and inside at the same time. So basically, the fellow there has got a very clear logical inconsistency.
Well, if I may recommend a book to you, it's called The Delusion of God by Richard Dawkins. And there's another book called Farewell to God by Charles Templeton, who used to be a preacher and later on decided to become an atheist. So perhaps you might want to look out for these two books. Okay, if one gets clinically depressed and unable to do anything for himself, what can he do? And why does mental illness occur in people? Is this karma?
Okay, it's mental illness occurs in people very much because of our lifestyles, because of our stress, because we work so hard, we have external prosperity, but internal poverty, internal famine, internal hunger, and that causes mental suffering. As human beings, we put a lot of resources into looking after our bodies, putting them in nice houses, driving nice cars, putting great perfumes and scents and makeup and clothes on us, exercising, getting health foods. But unless we look after our minds, then we're going to have mental illness. And one of the reasons for mental illness, especially depression, is because as human beings we think we can control the world. We really think we are control freaks. If you're not, the boss in your office is. And because of being a control freak, eventually we always get to a point where we can control no more. When we find out that life is much bigger than us. And when we get to that point, we usually get frustration. Maybe just frustration with your children, or frustration with your partner, or with your life. Why is it not going the way I want it to? Why is it not going the way it should do? We're asking something of life which it cannot give us. It's our demands are not realistic. Because of that, we get frustrated. After frustration, we get anger. That's where anger comes from. When it shouldn't be this way, you shouldn't be this way, life shouldn't be this way, Singapore shouldn't be this way, SIA planes should go off on time. It's not SIA's problem, the things go wrong in life, Murphy's Law. So understanding that, I never get upset if the plane is delayed. It's not the aircraft's fault. It's just nature. So we get frustrated, at least the anger, and after a while, the anger gets so bad, we get depressed. We give up. It's a waste of time. That's actually being completely dysfunctional. If we don't demand so much of ourselves and so much of life, or rather we have realistic demands, I don't mean we should be lazy. We work hard, we don't demand success, we don't demand our wife to be like Angelina Jolie, we don't demand our boyfriend to be like Brad Pitt, we don't demand our boss to be like Ajahn Brahm, we don't demand our life to be, like in the movies. We don't demand our children to always come top of the class. So saying in Malaysia, if you're a Buddhist, and your child comes in the top 5% or the bottom 5%, they're not good Buddhists. Good Buddhists don't come in the top 5%, nor do they come in the bottom 5%. Good Buddhists, middle way. They come in the middle somewhere. Gee, you should know that by now. So if your child comes in the middle somewhere at school, well done, you're a really good Buddhist, middle way.
Actually, I was in Khao Lak last weekend, and when I got to the check-in counter to get on a flight, the flight was delayed by 2 hours. We were actually delighted because we went off to Phuket town for shopping. Ajahn Brahm, both Sri Lanka and Thailand faced tsunami destruction. But I think both countries have come out quite differently, despite the fact they were both Buddhist countries. Could you comment on that, please, in terms of how one responded to it?
Yeah, first of all, that Thailand is a much wealthier country than Sri Lanka. And I think Thailand is, except for the southern provinces, much more united as a people than Thailand, than Sri Lanka. Because Sri Lanka's different members of their island, now there is a war going on between the north, the Tamil Tigers, and the Sinhalese government. It's a terrible thing that that's happening. It should never have got to that point. A lot of times it seems to be because of nationalists who've got some really some strange agendas which I don't agree with. And actually the moderate, tolerant Buddhists were not heard. So there's still a possibility. There was actually, I'm going to Sri Lanka tomorrow night. And obviously I'm going to give many, many talks over there. It's a great shame that Buddhists in Sri Lanka didn't show the way with peace, forgiveness, compassion, tolerance, and even sacrifice. In other words, you know, just let's end this war. It doesn't matter how many people of my race you kill, I am not going to kill anyone of your group. Because Dharma is more important. We take refuge not in our nationality, not in our race. We take refuge in Dharma, in truth, in peace, compassion, virtue, peace, and compassion. But I always like the saying of Gandhi, who once said, I can see 1,000 reasons for giving my life for a cause. I can't see one reason for taking the life of another person. And that's why a person like that was a great leader and inspiration. I don't mind sacrificing my own life, but I'm not going to take someone else's. Now there's something noble and high about that. And such nobility, such high virtue, is incredibly powerful. Those are the sorts of people, the Gandhis, the Mandelas, who actually change our world for the better.